Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm Giuseppe Porcaro, and here at Bruegel, we are undergoing a research project on the future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. The project analyzes the impact of technology on the nature, quantity, and quality of work, welfare systems, and inclusive growth at large. The Sound of Economics is proud to contribute to the project with a space for discussion and analysis on this theme. Today, we are going to zoom in to understand better self-employment and its current challenges, as well what we can learn from this category about the future of work. For this conversation, I'm happy to welcome Milena Nikolova, who is a non-resident fellow at Bruegel and an associate professor at the University of Groningen. Hi Milena, how are you?
Hi Giuseppe, I'm very well and very happy to be on the podcast.
Great. And also joining us from the United States, there is Diane Mulcahy, if I pronounce it correctly. I'm not sure, Diane. Diane is a visiting fellow at Bruegel, and she's an expert on the gig economy. Hi, Diane. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Giuseppe. Thanks so much for having me. And for the Americans in the audience, I'll pronounce my name with an American accent. It's Diane Mulcahy.
Thank you. So back to the topic. The rise of independent work, self-employment, and the growth of the gig economy are all disrupting the traditional model of full-time employees working one job with one single employer. So first thing first, Diane, can you help us understand better what we mean when we speak about self-employment?
Sure. I would say the most important distinction to keep in mind is that when we talk about self-employment, we are referring to the solo self-employed. And what that means is people working for themselves without any employees, people who are working independently. So it's distinctly different from small business owners. I think that's the biggest distinction to keep in mind. The second thing I would say about self-employment is just that it's incredibly diverse. I mean, it can include the traditional model of working for yourself, in other words, hanging out your own shingle, or becoming an independent contractor. But what's interesting is with the growth of the gig economy and independent work in general, it can also mean working a side gig in addition to a full-time job. Taking on tasks like driving or doing errands or dog sitting or consulting or any other skill or interest that you have. And it can also mean just foregoing a full-time job completely and creating a portfolio of gigs with different clients. So I think what's interesting about the way the economy has evolved is that there are now so many different ways to be self-employed and work for yourself.
So it's far from being a monolith group, but, and I'm looking at Milena, in this diversity of models, gig, traditional self-employment, consultancies, freelancers, and so on, how can we districate ourselves in this forest of different trees, if I can use a metaphor over there? Also in terms of different levels, I suppose that not every self-employed is the same in terms of categories and what they earn and what they do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely right. And to add to the complexity, also the motivations to start a business can differ. So we know that there's the so-called opportunity self-employed and the necessity self-employed. And so traditionally, I think in the literature, but also in policy circles, people have thought of self-employment as precarious employment, but that's not the case. As Diane just pointed out, you have the high-skilled, high-earning freelancers. So be that, for example, computer programmers that are doing specific tasks or projects for firms. And you have, of course, the precariously employed gig workers, and for example, delivery bike workers and things like that. But actually, what we know is that the majority of entrepreneurs and majority of the self-employed are starting a business to pursue an opportunity. So in Europe, it's about 3/4 of those who start a business do so in the pursuit of an opportunity. So they're the so-called opportunity self-employed, and. Yeah, it's true that they're a diverse group, and they have diverse experiences in terms of their job quality, in terms of the content of their work. And the best that we can do is to first of all acknowledge these distinctions that is not done consistently in at least in the academic literature, and then second of all measure these distinctions correctly through eliciting information from the self-employed or through the chambers of commerce where they have to register, et cetera. And then maybe just one addition to what Diane already said, it's so the way that I will talk about the self-employed in this podcast, it will also include those who employ others. But what we know is that in principle, the self-employed who employ others are the smaller share of the self-employed. So about 2/3 of all self-employed are solo self-employed or solopreneurs, if you will. Hmm. So in that sense, there will be a lot of overlap with what Diane means.
Yeah, and I would love to just add on because I think, you know, because we are going to talk a little bit about policy later on this podcast, and I just think the idea that the self-employed are solopreneurs, that in many ways they are the entrepreneurial class. And I think that's a really helpful framework, particularly for policymakers to think about how to frame the impact that the self-employed have on the economy, is to think of them like entrepreneurs, because so many countries and cities and economic entities are concerned with economic development, with positive contributions to the economy. And the self-employed are really an important factor in that. So it's a really helpful way to think about and frame this topic of self-employment.
That's a great point.
That's a very good point. But also, we shouldn't forget what Milena said about the opportunity self-employed and the necessity self-employed. And I will want to come back on that, because I think that on these, there might be quite big differences in the way you think about the approach. But zooming a little bit in what has been going on in the past couple of years, because we had the pandemic, and somehow the pandemic accelerated this process, especially for certain categories. I wouldn't say that for every category had the same impact, but definitely knowledge workers, for example. I mean, if we want to take a concrete example of how this has been deployed, they have been particularly affected by the pandemic, from teleworking to other possibilities of basically develop further. And Milena, you've been exploring this a bit more in details in a blog, which we are linking in the show notes. And you've been finding out that we can learn some stuff. They can give us a glimpse into the future of work in a post-pandemic world by seeing the experiences of the self-employed. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, sure, Giuseppe. And what you said is exactly right. So the pandemic really required this overnight sudden shift to teleworking that was new to many people. So I'm mostly talking about knowledge workers here. So these are the workers that are typically doing their work at a desk in an office, frequently working with computer, some other technology. And so overnight, the kitchen tables and in some cases, ironing boards became desks or standing desks. And in Europe, the percentage of teleworkers, for example, increased from 5% in 2019 to 40% in 2020. it has decreased a bit once now offices are open again and restrictions have been lifted. But still, a large share of workers are still working from home and expressing strong preferences in surveys that they would like to continue working from home at least part of the time. And so in this blog post that you mentioned that I wrote for Bruegel in 2021, I argue that indeed the changes that the pandemic created made, and especially this rise in teleworking, made traditional work for the knowledge workers look like non-traditional work, like self-employment. And so the argument that I made there was that based on the following observation. So we know that the self-employed, especially those who start their business voluntarily and pursue opportunities, so the opportunity self-employed, report high job satisfaction. They report better health outcomes, more autonomy in their work, etc. And that's despite the fact that they often have to work long hours, they have conflicting demands, they have blurred lines between what is work and what is leisure time. And what we know from a large body of literature from multiple disciplines is that the reason why the self-employed report high satisfaction with their work is because of the freedom that they have and the flexibility that they have. And there's really something to being your own boss. Yeah, there is some sort of satisfaction with having no hierarchy. And so, in a way, the pandemic made the job conditions of knowledge workers a lot like those of the self-employed. So what do I mean by that? So like the self-employed, the knowledge workers who suddenly started increasingly teleworking found this new autonomy and freedom and the ability to self-organize. So in that sense, they started looking a lot like the self-employed. So, for example, teleworkers can more flexibly decide on their working time. They can shift tasks around with some degree to accommodate, for example, household chores and other tasks. And they have the ability to take breaks when they wish. And so this freedom and autonomy that they have may actually be good for them. And we know from research that freedom and autonomy also boost productivity. And so we also know that commuting is one of the least pleasurable times of day for people. And that's quite understandable for anybody who has spent 2 hours in traffic. But by eliminating this necessary commuting time, teleworkers can become more happy, and we know that happier workers are also more productive. And of course, there is a flip side to all of this. So of course, teleworking, just like self-employment, has job demands. Yeah, so it has different kinds of challenges for workers. So workers have reported working longer hours. They have increased responsibilities, more distractions at home, conflicting priorities. Much like the self-employed, they have blurred lines between what is their work time and what is their leisure time. And of course, they socialize less with their colleagues. So that leads to loneliness and isolation. And nevertheless, surveys find that 70% of respondents to a recent Eurofound survey that was conducted during the pandemic are satisfied with working from home. So there is something to that and to the autonomy and flexibility that it brings. And so I think that for the future of work, I think that teleworking in a hybrid form combined with going to the office a few days a week is here to stay.
And definitely, this is an interesting reflection. And I wanted to ask Diane as a follow-up and a comment to what you're saying. So are we seeing a sort of blurring of the lines between self-employment and employment itself? How do we interpret what Milena just told to us?
I mean, I think, there's maybe some blurring in the sense that, you know, self-employed individuals have always had the autonomy, the flexibility, the control that Milena is alluding to. And it's very clear when you look at the data that self-employed workers who do have control over the type of work that they do, you know, they can take projects or turn them down, that have control over when and where they work or who they work with, those workers definitely are the happiest, the most productive, the most satisfied, the most engaged. So I think in many ways, the pandemic did blur the lines between employees and the self-employed. But I do think there remains key differences. Employees are still under the control of companies, and we've seen a somewhat disturbing trend of companies increasing or looking for other ways to exercise control over their employees that can look like monitoring, installing software, monitoring keyboards, monitoring working times, monitoring activity. So there are ways that companies exert control over their employees, including demanding that they come back to the office, that the self-employed are really exempt from. So I think that's an important difference, is the issue of control. And we are starting to see some of that as return to work starts to happen. And I think it remains to be seen how work evolves once we do settle into a new way of working. I think during the pandemic, isolation was a problem. Lack of boundaries was an issue because people were forced to work from home in situations where they didn't have a good work from home setup. Now that people are pursuing hybrid options, that they're able to go back to co-working spaces, there are many more ways, I think, to include socialization in the workday or access the structure and the socialization of an office without completely giving up the autonomy and flexibility and control that work from home workers got used to during the pandemic. So I think it's a little bit more nuanced in terms of the differences. And when we think about where will we end up, what is the steady state?
Everything you're saying at the moment seems to me or resonates to me to the example of the opportunity self-employed. What about the necessity self-employed in this situation? And Milena, you've been writing in another blog post some reflections on the well-being of self-employed people and how we can learn out of those needs. So perhaps it would be interesting to understand, you know, what can we learn in terms of other needs that this category or like part of this category might have, and what kind of implications they should have to, broadly speaking, in this case, implement better policies for the workers.
Thank you very much for pointing out this important distinction. Indeed, there is a difference between workers who are starting a business because they just don't have any other opportunities to earn an income, the necessity self-employed, or if they're starting a business because they have identified an important market niche and they see opportunities to grow their income or learn new things and develop themselves. And so the studies in the literature have started paying a lot of attention to this distinction lately. And what we know is that the necessity self-employed are in a way oftentimes precariously employed. So they don't realize, for example, these well-being benefits that I spoke about. So when we often talk about, you know, the self-employed are more satisfied with their working conditions, and may even have higher incomes. That's not true for everyone, as Diane already spoke earlier. So I think that taking into account this important distinction is important for policy making. So the upshot of all of this is that necessity self-employment is at least based on the self-reported information that we have about the share of necessity self-employment worldwide. It seems to be a smaller share of the overall self-employment. So it's about 25%. So, of course, these kinds of boundary conditions or these kinds of distinctions between necessity versus opportunity self-employed are important in helping us understand better the job quality and working conditions of the self-employed, but also of regular employees. And another important distinction that I have looked into in my own work is the distinction between the solo self-employed and those who employ others. And we have compared them with employees working in a firm. And among those employees, those who have managerial capabilities, so those who supervise others, and those who have no supervisory status. And we analyzed data for over 80,000 workers living in 30 European countries from 2005 to 2015. And perhaps the most surprising finding there was that the solo self-employed, the solopreneurs, had the greatest autonomy levels. And they worked less and had less stress compared to other groups. And this may be because they can more flexibly decide their working schedules. They don't have the pressure and stress of managing others, for example. But it's not quite clear whether these people are really, let's say, the best well-off group in terms of their job quality and working conditions. Because when we compared other outcomes, it turns out that these solopreneurs earn less than the business owners that Diane spoke about, than those who employ and supervise others. They have also more monotonous tasks. They have greater job insecurity. They report that they learn less on the job and that they have lower career chances. And they report, by the way, importantly, that they have less meaningful work compared to those who supervise others. So all of this is to say that well-being at work is not just about the working conditions or the salary. It's about looking at the working conditions and salary and the autonomy and the job satisfaction and the work meaningfulness of individuals, and just looking at the whole picture holistically, and more nuanced conditions emerge. And so it matters essentially at which working conditions and well-being outcomes one is looking at to arrive at the conclusion of let's say how well the solopreneurs are doing compared to other groups.
I think that's so true and such an important concept to keep in mind, this idea that, you know, one person's good job is another person's nightmare. So there are, if you look at people who make choices about working in situations that don't optimize their income, that might seem really precarious. If you think about actors or entrepreneurs or artists, those jobs don't come with many of the trappings that we might consider requirements for a quote unquote good job, a high salary or good working conditions or security and stability. But people make those choices every day. It's such an individual choice and preference about what work people prefer, find meaningful, and get joy from. It's really hard, I think, to generalize on that point. And so I think that's a really important point to keep in mind when you think about, you know, what is good work and what is bad work. I also think Milena's point about precariousness, which has come up a couple of times in this podcast, is important to think about. I know, particularly during this downturn that we've had in 2022, there are many full-time workers who believe that full-time work in a traditional job feels very precarious. Mm-hmm. There are any number of employees that have been laid off without any warning, with very little notice, and with little severance, if any, who feel very unstable and like their professional lives are precarious. So I think it's important to just recognize and explicitly note that having a job doesn't guarantee stability or security, nor does self-employment. And it really does depend on personal experience and the situation of the individual worker, which situation feels more stable and secure for them. In the class that I teach at Babson, in the MBA class, there are many students who feel like self-employment, where they have multiple streams of income and diverse client base, feels much more secure to them than relying on a single employer and one paycheck for their financial security.
Diane, but I need to challenge you on that, because you come from a very American perspective here, and we are sitting in Brussels from at the Bruegel's office, and the situation in Europe is a little bit different in terms of job markets.
It is.
And it has to be recognized that in terms of legislations and in terms of workers' protections and in terms of rights that workers have, employees have, there is a gap. There is a gap in the way policymakers have been adapting to the pace of the change of the labor market. So it might be true in general that there might be situations where an employee is also as precarious as a self-employed, but there are also some legislative framework to be made more explicit here and maybe explained a bit more to our listeners, which is challenging here, where you still have some benefits and some rights which are granted only to employees, and other rights that are that have not been adapted to these new models of employment. So the situation is a little bit nuanced in that case. And you've been looking at specifically what the EU is doing, but also you've been looking at national regulations in a policy contribution that you wrote for Bruegel. So it could be interesting to dig a little bit more into this gap or this lagging behind of the legislation in adapting to the labor market.
I would agree with that. And I have written quite a bit on the policy issues around employee classification, which is an issue in the US and in the EU equally. The employment, the labor markets are a little bit different in terms of their, you know, how much risk they put onto individuals, but there are problems with the labor market structure in both places. And, you know, I think what's interesting about the growth of independent work in the gig economy, and in particular, the pandemic really shined a light on this, is that it's become clear that this two-category framework that the labor market is structured around is obsolete. And so what I mean by that is that in both the US and the EU, the classification system that the labor market is structured around is around two categories. Workers are classified either as an employee, which is, think about a traditional employee in a traditional full-time job working for a single employer, or they're classified as an independent contractor, which generally speaking will encompass the self-employed. The problem is that the way that people work has become so diverse that those two narrow categories no longer are effective at capturing the many ways that people work. And as a result, it's led to a lot of confusion and a lot of gray areas. in terms of classification and in terms of enforcement. So there are a number of negative consequences with this policy situation. It's made it riskier for independent workers and for companies to work independently, because it's hard to understand if I'm an independent worker or if I'm a company hiring an independent contractor, are they actually genuinely independent? And we've seen the lawsuits around willful or inadvertent misclassification of employees. So there's still a huge amount of risk and gray areas around that. So I think that that's something from a legislative or regulatory perspective that needs to be addressed. I think the problem is that it's such a big change and restructuring of the labor market that politically it's been very difficult to enact meaningful changes in that space. What we saw during the pandemic is that we are able to make changes that level the playing field between employees and independent contractors. Particularly, I'll use the example of unemployment insurance. During the pandemic, we saw a number of people who work as self-employed independent or independent contractors suddenly able to access unemployment benefits. You know, the US and the EU were very quick to make changes to provide income protection to people who usually weren't eligible for it. So I think that alone suggests that the changes are very possible if we have the political will.
That's very interesting. Milena, do you have something to add to what Diane just told us?
Well, Diane is clearly the expert here, but just to add, I think that it is increasingly important to address these issues, as Diane said, not least because indeed the nature of work is changing, and so companies and organizations are looking for more flexible and agile type of structure. So a lot of the work is, let's say, project-based or task-based. And so that's how work is done. So regulation and policies need to be adapted to reality, really.
And coming also because we are going soon towards the end of this episode, but we cannot leave by not asking Diane if she has some policy recommendations. I mean, you hinted about the fact that some changes are possible, that the pandemics have shown some of those changes, but what would be your policy recommendations on this regard to the governments, the European Union, and so forth?
Yeah, the the policy recommendation that I have is to restructure the labor market in a way that we eliminate the classification system, classify everybody as a worker, and ask companies and governments to provide either universal or prorated benefits. And that varies depending on the particular benefit or right to workers. So that removes the distortion that this categorization system creates, and it equalizes the incentives. So for example, one issue right now or historically has been the issue of misclassification. You have companies that purposefully misclassify workers as independent contractors rather than employees because it's generally cheaper to do so, and they can avoid providing those workers with benefits, rights, and protections that are only awarded to employees. If you classify everybody as a worker and the company has to provide, let's say, pension contributions or pay into an unemployment insurance fund based on how much that worker works for them rather than on their classification, you can eliminate many of those distortive incentives. So I think it's looking for something that really fundamentally addresses these issues. Similarly, some benefits, protections, and rights should go universally to all workers. One of the examples that myself and my co-authors talk about in the paper we did for Bruegel is protection against discrimination and harassment. That should be universal to all workers, no matter if you're working as an employee or as an independent contractor or as somebody who's doing a side gig. that should be a universal protection for all workers. So I think that's the direction we need to move.
Sorry, Diane, sorry to interrupt you. How this is different from the concept of flexicurity, which was very much in vogue a few years ago in different circles here in the EU.
Yeah, I think it is, because I think it is, rather than an incremental change, like the example I was going to bring up of how some member states have started to address this issue is by introducing a third category of classification. It's called different things in different countries, but let's just call it dependent contractor. And what those member states are trying to do is to find a third category that captures some of these gray zone cases and awards some benefits and protections to those workers. I would argue it doesn't quite go far enough. It just creates more distortions and more complexity in the labor market and still leaves out categories of workers. So in my mind, that's not a sustainable or good solution or policy. I really think we need to make a wholesale change that structures the labor market for a much more complex, diverse, varied workforce and ways of working that the future looks like it will have.
Thank you, Diane. And one last word from Milena to close the circle, I would say, before we close this episode. Coming back to the issue of the future work, and since the project on future work is looking exactly at that topic, once again, maybe some last words about what to expect for the future on this direction. I mean, Diane clearly sketched some ideas about the policy side. What do you think in terms of other lessons learned or other things that we haven't mentioned yet before we say goodbye?
Yeah, so very briefly, I think that making the well-being of workers a priority in of public policy is a key step in this process. So we know that well-being causally improves productivity, creativity, and all kinds of outcomes, which is good for companies, it's good for workers, and of course, it's good for governments as well. So I think that governments stimulating companies and workers to adopt policies that improve well-being and autonomy and improving workers' voice can do tremendous good in the future of work.
Thank you, and thank you to both of you once again. And unfortunately, this is all the time we have for this episode, but we will keep the conversation alive within the research project at Bruegel on future of work and inclusive growth in Europe. And The Sound of Economics will keep following the project, and there will be more episodes dedicated to the theme. So thanks once again also to our listeners, and I would like to remind that you will find the show notes, the link to the research works done by Diane and Milena on the topic which we discussed today. And as usual, you can read in open access all the analysis by our scholars on our website www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot for joining The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.